I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Jim Henson led the Shawnee Mission School District for 4 years. When he left last month, his sometimes controversial tenure saw modernization throughout the district, but left it struggling with some issues, including special education woes and a freedom of speech lawsuit. Today, we meet Michael Fulton, the new superintendent, and hear his approach to those hurdles and get his priorities for the district. Then, 5 years ago this week, Ryan Stokes was killed by Kansas City police. His mother says the department created a false narrative of the events leading to his death. We'll revisit the incident and hear about her lawsuit against the KCPD as we get you up to date after this hour's news. The more than 27,000 students and 4,300 employees in the Shawnee Mission School District have a new leader at the helm, and he's here with me today. Superintendent Michael Fulton, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Oh, great. So we know that there's a lot going on with the Shawnee Mission Schools specifically, and we're going to get to that. But let's just jump right in with an issue that districts across the state are grappling with, and that's school funding. I'm sure you're aware of the situation, or you're aware of the situation in Topeka before you took this new position. So how did that play into making you decide to take the job?
Well, funding is certainly an issue for schools across the country, and I certainly was aware of the challenges that Kansas is facing, both with the courts and school funding, but also making sure that Kansas students have the funding that they need to be successful learners. So it was certainly something I was aware of, but it's also an issue that we just need to continue to address as effectively as we can.
So there's this question in Kansas about who decides what's adequate and equitable when it comes to school funding. I guess the first question I should ask you is, what does that really mean?
Well, to me, adequate and equitable means that we have the ability to fund our schools in a way that makes sure that our students are college and career ready. Now, defining exactly what that means is important. That can be a little bit different by community. And certainly the way the courts look at that or the legislature looks at that may be a little bit different than, you know, maybe sometimes parents look at that. So when we talk about school funding, it's important to recognize at the end of the day, schools are for children and they're learning, and we need to do everything we can as a society to make sure that they're going to be successful learners today and ready for their future tomorrow.
So do you think that Shawnee Mission is equitably and adequately funded by the state?
I think every school has its funding challenges. In Shawnee Mission's case, I think the biggest challenge that we have going forward really is in the operating fund, which that's the fund that we use to pay staff salaries. It's important that we have enough teachers and other staff working with our children in ways that help them to learn. There are limitations on what we can do in terms of local expenditures. There's also the issue of whether or not Kansas is adequately funding the formula to make sure that we have the dollars that we need to help our students. So that's a challenge moving forward.
So I know I'm throwing a lot at you, so I'm going to ask this question. Lawmakers this year passed a package to phase in an increase of $522 million in school funding over the next 5 years, but the Supreme Court ruled that that proposal was insufficient. Do you have any urgings you would give to the lawmaker about where to go from there?
Well, I would say continue to work toward adequately and fully funding the formula as it's been defined. And I know that's the question, you know, what is it? What is the adequate level of funding? And so we just need to do the very best job to fund that at an adequate level. The courts have certainly weighed in on what that means, and that makes sense. We need to keep working toward that target.
Have you met with any of the state lawmakers yet who represent your district?
I'm in the process of meeting a lot of constituents, including state lawmakers and folks that represent us at the federal level. And that's something that certainly is a topic of conversation. But I will also say this, being new to Kansas, it's an area that I'm still getting up to speed on in terms of understanding the specifics of the Kansas funding formula.
This is KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, sitting in for Steve Kraske. We're getting to know Dr. Michael Fulton, the new superintendent of the Shawnee Mission School District. So at the Board of Education meeting on Monday, you know, just your second one, right, since you've taken office, were there teachers who talked about how they wanted a pay increase? I think you mentioned earlier that's part of what the budget is supposed to make sure that it covers.
Yeah, there were some teachers that did come to the board meeting and speak about the issue of pay. We have a defined process for engaging in negotiations that works very well, and I'm certainly going to honor that by not addressing negotiations specifically in a public forum. But I will say this, we care about our teachers. We certainly respect and value the great work that they do every day. And in Shawnee Mission and in schools around this country, we need to do the very best job we can to make sure that our teachers are well compensated and have the tools that they need to be successful as they help our kids become college and career ready.
So you came from a suburban district in St. Louis, is that correct?
It was a suburban district, and it was a very diverse district. Okay. Something of what that was a point of pride for us. We really believe that, and I believe that diversity is absolutely a strength in any school district. And along with that comes the expectation that all children are capable of high performance. Our job is to design learning systems that get them there.
So when people say diversity, you guys, excuse me, I'm someone who's big on the diversity and inclusion topic. I have that kind of background. But what exactly do you mean by diversity? Because that is kind of a broad word.
Diversity, in my mind, is really about the depth and breadth of the human experience. So diversity is often associated with race, but it's much broader than that. It's about language, culture, country of origin, religion. There's a broad perspective of diversity that needs to be understood, honored, and respected as we learn to work with each other in community to help us help our children be ready for a future. It's critical because they are going to face a future that's not yet invented. There are jobs that are not yet invented that they will hopefully be ready for when they exit our schools. And as the America grows more diverse, we simply cannot afford to leave any child behind in terms of our ability to help to educate all children effectively.
Well, that's a good transition to the other thing I was going to ask you about. Another issue that came up at a recent board meeting is special education. So the district's special education program has been in a bit of disarray. Complaints from parents about children being ignored, the director stepping down, high staff turnover, the state's requirement that the district submit a corrective action plan. There's a lot going on with that. Could you tell us a little bit about how you plan on picking up with that?
There have been a number of concerns expressed publicly, and that's well known. What we've done is we've done some reorganization of our administrative staff. One of those changes was to have one of the assistant superintendents take on a new title. She's going to now be the assistant superintendent for personalized learning, and for this year also serve as the interim director of special education. Now that's very intentional. First of all, we have a director's job open because the current director is going to step into an assistant director's role. The person who's going to go into the director spot, that assistant superintendent, is going to do a great job of working with parents and students and staff in helping to effectively meet the needs of all of our special education students. And in Kansas, special education applies not only to students with cognitive or behavioral challenges, but also to gifted students. She'll address that. But more broadly speaking, now as the Assistant Superintendent for Personalized Learning, she'll also be an important member of the team who will help us move toward creating more personalized learning environments for all children. That's where the future sits in learning. Personalized learning for children, having certain equity targets that we want to make sure that all children hit so they can be successful learners, not just at school, but over the course of their lifetime.
Could you give me an example of what you mean by personalized learning in the classroom?
Personalized learning in the classroom can manifest itself in a lot of ways. But as one example, let's say that I am a sixth grader and I'm interested in a couple different career options. Maybe I want to be a brain surgeon. Maybe I want to be a professional baseball player. Or maybe I'm also interested in plumbing. You know, part of what we need to do with students is to allow them to explore those interests in ways that they understand what those jobs entail. But importantly, also make sure that they have the academic background that they need to be successful in pursuing any or all of those options. So in a personalized learning environment, you're recognizing the strength of every child. You're listening to what they have to say about what their interests are. And to the very best of our ability, we're working to customize the learning experience to help them become who they want to be.
This is KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, sitting in for Steve Kraske. We're sitting down with the new superintendent of Shawnee Mission Schools, Dr. Michael Fulton. So, what's your background? I know you were superintendent. Were you a teacher?
I was a teacher for nearly 10 years. I worked at both the elementary and middle school levels as a teacher, and I loved the classroom. One of the hardest career decisions I made was to move from being a classroom teacher and going into administration. My career has really been focused on student learning. Even as an administrator, all of my time has been spent working with teachers to create the very best learning environments possible for all children. That's my passion. I believe that every child matters. I believe that we have to create schools that really are designed around the learners that we serve. But also, we need to hold high expectations for all kids and as adults, design learning experiences and structures that support them in their learning.
So is it true that Shawnee Mission School District is quite a bit bigger than the district that you just came from? What's it called again?
It's the Pattonville School District.
Pattonville School District,
right.
Yes.
It is bigger, about five times bigger. But the way that I frame it is this. You improve schools one child at a time. School improvement happens by working from the child up. The relationship between one child and their teacher or teachers, that's where the difference is made in terms of learning. And so whether you have 100 kids in a school district or 100,000, everything goes back to the child and their relationship to the teachers that they have. So that's how you break a complex problem down into more manageable chunks.
So as you're aware more than anyone, partly because you came from the St. Louis area, and just because nationally students, high school students, are being more active in terms of how they express themselves, and maybe it's not more active, it's just, you know, cycles of how the young people, you know, express themselves. How do you feel that you're going to be able to deal with that in the upcoming years? Do you have any strategies that you've implemented or that you plan to implement in terms of things like another National Student Walkout Day?
Sure. At the end of the day, the most important thing that we do in schools is develop relationships with one another. And it's been my experience that when you take time to develop relationships with students, to hear their voice, to understand their concerns, that when you get into local or national events that have students wanting to be in a position where they can express that voice, that you use those relationships, both students and staff, in ways that help students to find appropriate ways to express their opinions on various topics. We have, as you know, in the St. Louis area, had a number of walkouts or statements of concern by students. Certainly, Ferguson ignited some of that. And what we just simply work with our students in ways that are very relational and help them to find voice in ways that are appropriate. I think that's the key.
Okay, so your first day on the job was about a month ago, this month. But the big test comes shortly, first day of school. When's the first day of school again in Shawnee Mission?
The first day of school is September 10th.
September 10th. So any plans on how you're
I'm sorry, August 10th, not September 10th. I don't want to get the kids too excited about a longer vacation. Let me repeat that. August 10th.
You just made the hearts of so many kids, because I'm sure there are a lot of Shawnee Mission kids and parents listening who were just so happy.
There was a glimmer of hope for the kids and concern on the parents' part, I'm sure. No, it's August 10th.
August 10th. Well, you don't have long to prepare how that first day is going to go. Any plans on how you're going to introduce yourself to the student body?
Well, we're working on that right now. I'm working on an entry plan. The challenge in a district of any size is to personalize the experience as a superintendent to the students in particular. So I'm working on some strategies where I can get into schools, introduce myself to staff and students. That's going to take a while. And we're still working on the issue of how on the first day of school I can do a personal connection to students. But that's something that will chip away at. I'm looking forward to that, by the way. One of the great things about being in education is you get to interact with students. That's what we're there for, and they're great fun to be with.
That is very true. I've worked in a couple of schools, and that really is the best part, yes. That's Dr. Michael Fulton. He's the new superintendent for the Shawnee Mission School District. Dr. Fulton, thank you. I wanted to ask you one more question, though, before you left. You know, from your experience in being in Pattonville, you were there for 11 years. Were you a superintendent for somewhere else before that?
No, actually, I was in Pattonville for 11 years as superintendent, but 23 years in total. I lived in the community, and all of my kids, our four children graduated from Pattonville as well. So I would say it was a long time.
Okay, so what's the big lesson? What's the big lesson that you learned as a superintendent on that you think you can bring to Shawnee Mission from your previous superintendent jobs on how you, because again, I've worked for schools, and you have a lot of constituents. You have the board, you have parents, you have teachers, and you have students. What's your big tip to yourself on how you make all that work, how you keep all that in the air?
I'm absolutely, relentlessly really focused on this notion that every child matters, because they do. And the belief that it is our job to do the very best we can to help every child be college and career ready, to be high school course content ready. And as adults, we need to work together to make that happen for them. It's their future. Our job is to design great learning environments that personalize the experience in ways that kids find meaning, hope, and direction for their future. That's a consistent narrative that you'll hear from me, and it never changes.
And are there ways that you personally help to do that outside of the classroom experience?
Out of the classroom experience, you know, one of the things that I do in my role as superintendent, but also as a community member, is to just work with a broad base of constituents and groups who are connected into building community and do what I can to get them connected into the process of helping children be successful learners. That could be chambers, it can be mayors, it can be religious leaders. We need to build community and help kids be successful in their learning.
Great. That's awesome. And I asked that question because I know a lot of administrators at schools have other jobs, whether they coach or they're a debate leader or something. I was just wondering if you had some extra thing that maybe teach knitting to the students. You know, is there some extra thing that you do to kind of keep yourself connected with the students?
I do have strategies I've used in the past to intentionally meet with student groups to stay connected with them, get to activities. Of course, Shawnee Mission is a big district, so getting to all the activities is going to be challenging, if not impossible. But I just try to have a presence and stay connected with students.
Well, Dr. Michael Fulton, thank you very much. This was the new superintendent for the Shawnee Mission School District. Still ahead, we revisit the 2013 shooting death of Ryan Stokes at the hands of Kansas City Police. Stay with us. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we checked in on the state of foster care. On the Missouri side, kids are overly prescribed psychotropic drugs. In Kansas, agencies can turn away prospective parents based on religious beliefs. Hear more at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, even though it's different from marijuana, it has been illegal for Kansas farmers to grow industrial hemp. Until now. But growing the crop may still come with challenges. Join us tomorrow on Up to Date to hear about those hurdles. On July 28, 2013, Ryan Stokes was shot twice in the back and killed by police in Kansas City, Missouri. It's been nearly 5 years, and Ryan's family says they're still waiting on answers from the department and that their patience for justice has worn thin. Today, we'll revisit that night and talk about the lawsuit the family has filed. They're seeking an accurate recounting of the shooting as well as changes to the department's policies on foot pursuit and next of kin notification. They also say they're still waiting on an apology from Officer William Thompson, the 21-year-old department veteran who killed Ryan in 2013. With us today, Noreen Stokes, Ryan Stokes' mother. Welcome.
Thank you.
Cindy Short, the family's attorney.
Good morning.
And Peggy Lowe, she's a reporter here with me at KCUR. Her special investigation into the death of Ryan Stokes came out this morning. You can find it on kcur.org.
That's right. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. I mean, I've already said good morning to you, but good morning again. We also reached out to the Kansas City Police Department to join our conversation. Their spokesperson said the department could not comment on pending litigation. So, Peggy, could you just give us an overview of what happened the night of Ryan's death? And I'm sorry, Noreen, that I'm talking about your son in this impersonal way, but
okay.
I just wanted to say that.
Yeah.
So, could you just give us a brief overview?
Of course. So, the night of July 28th, 2013, actually it'd be the 27th, Ryan and his buddies, they all went to Southeast High School, and they went down to the Power and Light, what they often called the Power and White, because obviously there were dress codes and other things in place that were rather discriminatory, they felt, towards them. You couldn't, you know, sort of dress black in the Power and White. They went down and they just walked around the edges. They saw a ton of friends. It was really packed that night. Suddenly about 245, 250, something around there. They were right at the edges of Power and Light, and some Johnson County young men came rolling out of one of those country bars, and one of them had dropped his phone, and suddenly he started accusing Ryan's friend, Ollie Outley, of stealing it. Ollie hadn't. He denied it. A scuffle happens. Police used pepper spray. The crowd scatters. Ryan and his buddies started running towards the parking lot where their car was, and police followed, again, you know, putting out on the radio that he was accused of a stealing. He runs into the lot right behind the Zoo Bar at 12th and McGee, and he is getting ready to surrender to the bike cops who followed him in when Officer William Thompson, who'd been a veteran of the force for about 21 years, he was on the north side of the lot. We don't think that Ryan even knew Officer Thompson was there. Mm-hmm. And Officer Thompson shot twice, and Ryan was killed.
So, Peggy, have any of the details changed since this was first reported on back in 2013?
Virtually every detail has changed. I mean, the initial story that cops told is that Ryan was armed, that he forced a standoff, and he wouldn't put down his gun or he wouldn't surrender, so that's why they had to shoot him. And they told his mother that he was shot 5 times in the chest, when in fact he was shot twice in the back.
So has the police department, in any of their statements, have they changed what they originally said?
No, not to my knowledge. I don't think that they have changed that at all. And they have changed their hotspot policing that they were doing that night, but only because then Chief Daryl Forte, that was one of his pet projects, he is now gone.
What's hotspot policing?
That means that they had like certain areas that were known to be high crime areas, and they would just really flood the zone with lots and lots of officers.
So what was considered a high crime area?
I don't even know that Power and Light is considered high crime, but that night they deployed tons and tons of officers down there because it was the Major League Soccer All-Star Weekend, and there was tons of stuff going on at Power and Light.
So what made you decide to re-examine and report on this?
Well, it's been 5 years. It'll be 5 years come Saturday. And we noticed that several things have changed, including the way police do these deployments and also the way the grand jury looks at it. Jackson County Prosecutor's Office now requires a different and more transparent kind of process for looking at these officer-involved shootings. And yet we noticed that nothing had happened to the Stokes family, that they still hadn't received justice. So we wanted to write about that.
So, Noreen, I know this is probably still very painful for you, but I know that one of the issues is next of kin notification. Could you tell us how the police came to your house and told you of your son's death?
Well, the first thing they did was called in. Detective Randall from the Kansas City Police Department addressed himself and said he was calling me due to the welfare of Ryan. So on the phone, I was like, welfare of Ryan, you know, we've been calling. We want to know what's happening, what's going on. I mean, where's Ryan? He tells me, can we meet somewhere? That threw me right there. When he said, can we meet somewhere to talk about the welfare of Ryan? I said, no, you can come to my home. You can come and talk to me because I need to know what's happened here or what's going on. And I tried to stay as, you know, calm and collective as I could. And it looked like it took them forever, you know, to come to my home. Mm-hmm. Once they got there, it was like we were the, I guess, victims, or we were the ones that should be, you know, worried about them because they came full force. I mean, it was like Detective Randall, maybe some other detectives, I don't know their names, and the policemen were dressed like they had bulletproof vests on.
And didn't they block off?
And they blocked off the street. They parked all up on, I live right off of 71 Highway, and they parked, you know, we could see them. They were just like they were waiting on something to happen when they came to give me the report about Ryan.
So, I mean, so that probably added to your upset, I would imagine.
It did. It did. I just could not believe it. I was, it was hot like it is now. It was, you know, I was trying to keep myself really focused on what I was going to hear or what they were going to say to me. And when he said that Ryan had a gun, wouldn't put it down, so they had to shoot him 5 times in the chest. It was like a standoff.
They told you that night?
They told me that day, that Sunday. They told me that. Stood in my face. And told me that. Unbelievable.
Well, I'm so sorry. Yeah. I know this is part of the process that people have to keep taking you through this, but I just wanted to say
I'm so sorry.
But
I want people to hear it. I want it to be known that it's not right what they did to Ryan. And they think they just want me from my first statement and when I felt that they didn't want to hear us or to ask questions, I said, oh, so you want me to sweep it under the rug? You want me to be silent about you killing my son? You know, I don't think so. I can't do it because I had a lot of love for my son. So
he was your only son.
My only one, 24
right.
years old.
Right. I see you're wearing the cross. Was that one of his?
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Because he always
we buried him. in the cross that he wore. They even that they act like they didn't want to release that or give us that property to at least put Ryan away in what he wore every day. We had a hard time.
So, Cindy, before I ask you a question, I just want to mention that you and I have worked together.
Yes,
we as a playwright, I wrote a play about the firefighters' explosion in 1988 based on the work of journalist Mike McGraw, and you were one of the characters in my play. You weren't. I had to write a fictional version of you to be in the play, and that's how I got to know you. And you represented Brian Shepherd, one of the accused. So I just wanted to be fully transparent that we know each other and how we know each other. So could you tell us about the Ryan Stokes lawsuit? What are you seeking?
Nareen came to us shortly after she discovered that she had been lied to by the police department because, like all people who are injured, she wanted information. And she also wanted this not to happen to other families, and she wanted certain policies to be corrected. We began our journey in the fall of 2013. We didn't file a lawsuit for 3 years. And the reason we didn't file a lawsuit for 3 years is because we were trying to reach across the table. We were trying to get answers from law enforcement and from the prosecutors, and we were prepared to work on trust, work on relationships. And in every instance for the last 5 years, we have been met with silence. When you said today that you'd reached out to KCPD and they said they could not make a comment, they have been saying they cannot make a comment since Ryan was killed. The comments they did make, however, to the public were all deceptive. They were all false. And so the lawsuit was eventually filed because we could not get around the table without the lawsuit. And that was filed 2 years ago.
So a couple of things. First of all, who is the civil suit brought against?
The civil suit is brought against the individual officer, Officer William Thompson, and the police department.
And how do you know that the original statements were deceptive?
Well, we had a first indication from not only a doctor who had examined Ryan's body, but also from the coroner. And so the first statements were that he had a gun, that there was a standoff. There were many witnesses up there that night, including the young men that we've referred to, Ollie Otley, and another young man by the name of Kenny Can. Ollie owned a gun, which he had legally purchased and was in legal possession of the night of the events. His gun was in his car, which we were legally allowed to do. And so we knew from Ollie right off the bat that Ryan had never been in possession of a gun. We also knew from witnesses that we were able to contact early on that many people had seen him at various points that night. None of them had seen him in the possession of a gun. And then we got a video, a cell phone video that was taken at the corner where the altercation occurred that Peggy described. And in looking at both Ollie and at Ryan, we could tell that neither one of them had a gun on their person. And so we had a lot of evidence that suggested that that narrative was just plain false from the beginning.
This is KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, sitting in for Steve Kraske. We're talking about Ryan Stokes, a 24-year-old black man killed by Kansas City police in 2013. Nareen, I want to make sure that anybody listening who doesn't know much about this case has a context for who Ryan was. What was he doing at the time? What was his job, his profession? What was he doing?
Him and his father were running a dry cleaners, cleaning clothes. And Ryan was also interested in trying to get his own dry cleaners. But at the time, he was dedicated at working with his father, Clarence. And they just were together every day. They worked 6 days a week. He had a lot of potential in him, and Ryan was just a strong family person. Like I told Cindy, you know, my son, we felt like he was a old soul. He had an old soul in him because being the baby boy and the baby of the family, because he had a lot of girl cousins, no boys. You know, everybody just took to him. You know, he worked hard. He helped us. It was just his life. That's what he made his life of.
He was a father, too, yeah, right?
And he was a father. Enjoy. He had a little girl. I would have loved if he would have had a little boy, because that would have been off the chain. But he had a little girl, and she's off the chain. Now,
I don't know what it is about parents that seem to be more excited about having their grandsons. But you know.
Yeah. You would always want your boy first, but I didn't have my boy first either. So, he had a little girl. Her name is Nariah Marie Lee Stokes. And she tells you that. And she knows who her daddy is by us. She is sad to have to talk about him like he...
Right. You know, past tense. Yeah. And all
I
this.
I get choked up.
I understand.
We got a show, Google and Facebook. And it's just not right. Because he loved her. He was happy. Yeah. 2013, he was happy. And I knew that. And I was, too. That he was truly a blessing to us.
So, Peggy, I'm going to pivot to you on this. Not that it's a competition at all. Lord knows it's not a competition. But is there a reason, do you think, why Ryan's case doesn't resonate nationally the way, say, a Trayvon Martin or an Eric Gardner or Mike Brown has?
Right. I don't know. And actually, that was one of the determining factors that my editor and I talked about. Like, why isn't there more outrage in Kansas City about this case, which seems pretty clear? I mean, this is not the first time that Ryan Stokes' story has been in the media. These two women here, Nareen Stokes and Cindy Short, will talk to anyone about this. They go to protests. They go to meetings. They talk to reporters. And there just hasn't been that outrage here. You know, Nareen and I talked about it, too. And I think that's one thing Nareen wishes, is that his name would become like a national outcry.
Why, Nareen, do you have any thoughts on why, what it is about Kansas City, whether it's the Kansas City Black community, whether it's the Kansas City community in general, that doesn't seem to, I don't know, make that noise, do that to be, not to be flip, the work it takes to make someone a hashtag so that people know instantaneously what you're talking about and who you're talking about?
I was wondering that myself, you know. Kansas City, Missouri is a show me state. Why would they want it not to be known and shown? Because I think a lot of people, to me, they're scared. Because that's what I first told Cindy when I contacted her and Brian. I said, the police killed my son. We can't be scared of the police. Or you scared of the police because that's who did it. The mayor, he really upset me and made me angry because he said it doesn't happen here. So I think they have a lot of control over what goes on here, but want to shut it out or just want to use the good stuff and not the bad stuff.
You know, one of the things I've thought about a little bit, and maybe you can address this a little bit, Cindy, is so often you hear about people talking about the perfect victim narrative. Mm-hmm. And yet in a situation like this, I mean, I don't know what more you could say about Ryan to stand out as an example of, not that this should happen to anybody if it's an unjust shooting, but what do you think about that? What is it that do you think people need to hear for them to have more compassion or more interest, just basic interest in this case? You know, it's hard to say what exactly the problem is. I think one honest way to think about it is we don't value certain lives the same way we value other lives. and young black men are seen through a prism by much of society that is very negative and very unfair. I think that as an individual coming into this case, as a white female, I was extraordinarily moved by two things. One, watching people and the ways in which they described this young man, from his high school coaches to his friends to his neighbors. He was doing all sorts of good works that nobody knew about, no one asked him about. He was just genuinely a good man. Then the young men that he was hanging around with and were with him that night are also good men, working men. But I got this feeling that in some way, although they bleed Chiefs red and royal blue, that they don't have the same citizenship rights as others do. And so when we cross a certain line in this city, our citizenship value is different. It's a harsh thing to say, but I listen to these young men who are his friends, who are good people and good citizens, and if something happened in their home, they would not call the Kansas City, Missouri police. And so part of our motivation going forward is, how do we correct that? Because I don't want a young man who works for the city, who works for restaurants, who is working for the ammunition factory, who is raising their children, to think that our police department will not be responsive to them. In fact, if called, might be dangerous to them. And so we started out on this journey to try to correct that, to think that we could have a voice, that we could make a difference, which is why we didn't file a lawsuit for a long time, which is why we have focused on restorative justice. And yet the other side has been crushingly silent.
You know, you brought up the very phrase I was going to ask you about. What is, for those who've never heard that phrase, what is restorative justice?
Restorative justice is a way of looking at the criminal justice system. Generally is very adversarial. So we have sides, and we have winners, and we have losers. But the justice system really needs to be about restoration. We need to be able to come to a place, identify a problem, study that problem, and solve that problem as a community. And so when I first began working with the Stokes family, we sat around my house and we made lots of lists about what were the things that would make us feel whole having had this tremendous loss. And the first thing on that list was, we need to restore the identity of Ryan Stokes. It was not money. It was, the second thing on the list was, Kansas City needs to have a foot pursuit policy so that these kinds of dangerous chases do not begin when the initiating event is by a very intoxicated young person over a cell phone, for heaven's sakes.
And that's what happened, right? It was, you know, just to repeat for those who might be tuning into the conversation, it was a young white man who was incredibly intoxicated by he and his friend's own admissions. They were very drunk.
Yes, and hammered.
That was the word. Jeez. Yeah, that was the exact
was
quote.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned to a police officer and said, you know, someone stole my phone. And they just generally, I guess, pointed in the direction of Ryan and his friends. And Peggy, from reading your story, I don't recall that there was even any indication that Ryan and his friends necessarily even knew they were being pursued. Am I getting that right?
I don't believe they knew it at all. No, I think they were just sort of like, the pepper spray hit, they scattered, they went up the street. Ollie Otley had actually been hit by that spray, so he was really kind of struggling moving forward because he was blinded by it. So Ryan was going to get to the car first and run around and pick everybody and get out of there because things were getting ugly. So they just wanted to get out of there.
Well, the police were 30 or 35 seconds behind Ryan and Kenny. And so if you are moving, and it's a very short block, so if you're moving up at a less than a run but more than a jog up that block, you're 30 seconds behind. No one heard any police officer call to have them stop. So I believe the totality of the evidence shows that Ryan did not know until he faced Officer Straub that anyone wanted to talk to him.
Mm. Well, you know, Noreen, we don't have a lot of time, and I know there's so much to unpack, but I wanted to ask you about something before we left. I know you're planning a 5-year memorial cookout.
Yes.
And I'm sure this got to be really tough, but what awareness do you hope? Because I know that there's a Facebook post on it, a Facebook event page on it. What awareness do you want that to trigger for people?
That day, we have this 5-year memorial. I want them to still know we're telling the truth, and that the truth needs to be told. And we're doing what Ryan liked to do. The 5-year is bringing out what he liked to celebrate and be. And we want people to know that this was the kind of person Ryan was. He wasn't trying to, you know, be bad with the police or do anything.
Because it's about the narrative, isn't it?
It's a narrative.
It's about making sure that people know who he was, as well as the facts of what happened, right? Yes.
And his uncle was very articulate in saying that to the Board of Police Commissioners 2 weeks ago. He said, "We want you to correct the false narrative." Yes. And I thought that wraps it up right there.
So I want to thank the three of you for being here. Noreen, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Cindy, Peggy, really appreciate you guys being here. Yesterday on the program, we learned the medical options available in the Metro for people without health insurance. Find that conversation on kcur.org/up-to-date. Find us on Twitter. We're at @KCUR Up to Date. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, Harry Truman desegregated the armed forces with an executive order 70 years ago. We'll learn the history and hear from a retired Army colonel of color about her time in an integrated military. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and you are up to date.